Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we've got trades on top of trades on top of trades. Giannis Antetokounmpo is a Miami Heat. LaMelo Ball is a Minnesota Timberwolf. Julius Randle is in Brooklyn now. Nick Claxton is in Chicago. We talk about all of those deals and what they mean for the respective teams. We then shift to the W side. The Aces, interesting game against the Liberty, interesting game against the Wings. We talk about it. Marina Mabry ties the W record for points in the game. We talk about it. We got more all-star returns. We talk about it. We had fun on this one. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are you, sir?
I indeed am feeling good. I am feeling great. I'm happy to be here. I'm also excited to be here. I'd like to thank the Dunkers for being here to embrace their bounce once again. I'm ready to talk about a whole lot of basketball things because this has been a week.
Buddy, a week undersells it. And let me just start by saying, Steve, run from it, dreaded, etc. You can't hide from the excitement and general mayhem of the Southeast Division. We have trades to talk about, Steve, and we are going to be hovering in the Southeast for a little bit. And we start with the Miami Heat pulling off the blockbuster, landing their whale. Giannis Antetokounmpo and Bobby Portis will be members of the Miami Heat. Trade can't be official until July 6th, so we'll see if it expands from there. But as of now, Giannis and Bobby Portis set to become members of the Miami Heat. Tyler Hero, Khalil Ware, Jaime Jaquez Jr., Kasper Jakachonis, three first-round picks, a first-round pick swap, and a 2033 second-round pick, all headed to the Milwaukee Bucks, at least for now. We'll see if it expands to a three or four-team deal. But the big move is Giannis to Miami. And Steve, we have had plenty of conversations about the Miami Heat this season, the general ups and downs of their seasons, the way they tweak their offense. I had a full, what felt like a 30-minute rant at the trade deadline when Miami was one of, I think, two or three teams that did not make a move at all at the deadline. Mm-hmm. And then we hit the offseason, and it's Miami's in the lead. Miami's in the lead. Miami's in the lead. Minnesota's checking back in. Boston, we were okay. Now we're tapping in. Jaylen Brown's on the table. Jaylen Brown and stuff's on the table. Boston's the front runner. And then Miami lands Giannis.
Mm-hmm.
To call this an emotional roller coaster for you, boy, would be a massive understatement. But we are here. And I am intrigued by the Miami Heat actually pulling this off and doing so before free agency starts, because they obviously have a lot of work to do to fill out their roster. But I'll toss it to you, Steve. Where do you start with Giannis in Miami? What intrigues you most about him landing in Miami?
Oh, I thought we were getting the mic drop. I didn't know I was going to get the ball this early in the clock. All right, let's set a pick and roll. It's front of the screen. I think the biggest thing for me is, one, the most important thing for Miami is they did it. Mm-hmm. I still remember driving in my car somewhere, maybe been 10 years ago, and Pat Riley was talking about, we're still whale hunting. And they finally got one. Mm-hmm. In Giannis Antetokounmpo. And that in itself, that my reaction was like, well, they actually got him. It's over. It's done. Giannis is a Miami Heat. When you get to the fit, I think what's interesting is, one, I think Giannis Antetokounmpo and Bam Adebayo have a level of versatility together. And I think when you look at this Miami Heat team, my mind immediately went to, like, the defense is going to be the defense, and we'll talk about the defense. My mind went to, what does this mean offensively for Miami? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the time, and I thought it was interesting to watch people go from, oh, is Miami going to actually make the trade? Oh, Miami's going to make the trade. Oh, Miami's going to fall short again. And then they cash all the chips in, get Giannis, and it was a quick speed run to, well, Miami's not a contender. And I was like, that's quick. That was fast, because it's all these players you didn't think were good enough, because Miami's been stuck in the play-in, turning into Giannis Antetokounmpo, and now it's like, oh, well, they're not good enough anyways. It's fine. To the offensive fit, right? Miami's shifting this season to spacing the floor and looking to drive, and now you've added Giannis Antetokounmpo to that. I'm very intrigued, because you know what Giannis Antetokounmpo likes to do? He likes to drive the basketball. And
yeah, he does.
He will grab attention. He will force help. That's where my mind went first. Miami has always had to, during this era, work incredibly hard to get a team to pay attention. to get a team to send early help, to get a team to go with a double team. The thing last year was drive and kick was really fun. The concern was, okay, what if teams switch? What if you can't get in the paint? What if teams stay at home? Giannis Antetokounmpo is going to draw attention. He's going to draw early help. To this day, everyone will still see Giannis. They'll say the word wall, and teams will help. That's just a fact. That should unlock just drive and kick and more flow. Obviously, you can move him around the board. You can put him in the post. You can use him as a screener. You can screen for him and go inverted actions. You can get defenses to get two on the ball or at least feel uncomfortable about a matchup. That adds a different layer for the Miami Heat offense, in my opinion. Do they have more work to do roster-wise? Absolutely. But you have something that you have not had for a long time. And I think that's one of the most important things. Now, you pair that with Bam Adebayo. We talked to Cooper Moorhead earlier this year. A lot of the things that Bam Adebayo has grown with may go unnoticed because you're expecting a certain thing for him offensively, not understanding the responsibility that he has. And so when you look at what Bam has done as far as it's not just pick and roll, a dribble handoff, everything has to run through Bam. We've tried to evolve this, and Bam has evolved within it. So Bam spacing the floor and being willing to shoot more threes. Bam being willing to attack and make quick decisions. Bam being able to be used in different scenarios. That gives you a level of versatility. You can run stuff on two sides. You can space the floor. You can get to attacks. And you have a little bit more balance when one of them is on the bench and one of them is on the floor. So I think offensively, in theory, this should give Miami more of a boost as far as, okay, think about the East, right? How many people can you put in action against Giannis? Jalen Brunson, you can put him in action. Donovan Mitchell, you can put, like you can unlock a different portion of the program here while still doing what you do in the half court. I think the thing you got to remember about Miami, and specifically Eric Spoelstra, he's really good at getting the most out of the players that he has.
Yes.
And that's a hidden piece because you're going to have a Giannis that's going to have the floor spaced, that's going to have people around him that are going to have specific roles and jobs, and there's going to be requirements. So I'm intrigued there. I started with the offense. What are your thoughts?
Okay. No, I like that because I also want to start with the offense. Full disclosure, I have a Giannis/Heat piece coming out today. So by the time this drops, it should be out on yahoosports.com. So check that out. And one of the things Big that plug. I also want to start with.
Big plug!
had to sprinkle it in. But one of the things that I started with in the piece was, one, just kind of highlighting how good Giannis still is. It was an injury-plagued season for the Milwaukee Bucks as a whole. Giannis wasn't completely himself. There was a lot going on behind the scenes. There's plenty of articles on that front. But it was still 28-10-5 for Giannis in 29 minutes. He is still incredibly good. And when you zoom out with Miami acquiring him, there's the obvious narrative piece for Pat Riley looking for one last well before he rides off into the sunset and all this good stuff. But throughout this recent era of Miami Heat basketball, even going back to the Jimmy Butler portion, they're still making the finals. Jimmy Butler kind of wills them to the finals by kind of turning into a superstar level guy when it mattered most and turning into a guy that could draw two because of the bucket getting he would get. Giannis walks in, whether he is 100% healthy, 70% healthy, he's got the flu, he is a walking two on the ball in some capacity, isolation, post up, et cetera. And having that kind of force multiplier for Miami is so important for them for all the reasons that you listed. I am curious to see like how much of last year's system carries over. Like, I don't anticipate the Miami Heat being dead last in pick and rolls and dead last in off-ball screens like they were this year. I don't think they're going to certainly turn back into the older version of themselves either. I wonder what that middle ground is going to be. But to the spacing portion that you hit on, like, that is where I'm excited. Giannis, even last year, best driver in basketball among guys to log at least 300 last year. Well over 1.2 points per possession on trips featuring a Giannis drive, which is insane. He saw help on over 71% of his drives per second spectrum, Steve. The Miami Heat, not only did they see the lowest rate of help on drives in the league last year because of how they spaced the floor, how they would cut, et cetera, their help rate was over 10 percentage points lower than second place. Like, it was an incredibly large gap with what they saw. Putting Giannis into that kind of context, one, I do think the help rate is going to be higher because it's Giannis. But if you can still maintain those principles, I think it's not going to be as high as Giannis has seen in years past, which should make him even more dangerous as a driver. And if you are still trying to commit the level of attention that you normally give him, that should open up easier opportunities for Bam to attack tilted defenses, for Andrew Wiggins, if he's back, to attack tilted defenses, and so on and so forth. And so that's where I'm like, ooh, how much of this is carrying over? How is Giannis going to fit? How much is Giannis going to dictate changing? Because I think in terms of putting the pick and rolls back on the board, my eyes kind of go to what guards are they going to add? Because it's easy to say get shooting around Giannis because you need that so teams aren't able to build that wall. But you need to give Giannis some shooters that are also willing to screen, to fully unlock the inverted stuff, to unlock the ghost screens, to allow, you know, if he's going to be drawing attention, to have guys that can attack tilted defenses off the bounce versus just doing so from a standstill. So, like, that's going to be important. We're going to be tracking that as the actual free agency period kicks off in a week and a half from now. But I'm intrigued to see, like, what Giannis as a driver looks like in this context, just as a downhill threat overall in this context. I would imagine the post-ups are going to ramp up, as you already alluded to. Him being in the playoff too, and Miami's off-ball principles from there. Like, one of the things we talked about early last year, again, they weren't a high off-ball screening team overall, but when they did get to it, they loved their flares, they loved their pin-ins. And it's kind of been a staple for Miami over the last two seasons in particular. Hey, man, try to double Giannis if you want to, if they have that stuff still baked in. Spo plus Giannis, I'm right there with you. I am just intrigued by the offense. Can I ask you a question on the defense front? Unless you had more that you want to get to on the offense.
No, go ahead. Ask away.
Oh, okay. So I think on paper, Giannis plus Bam should just be insane when you have bigs that are that versatile, especially when fully locked in. Because Giannis, I think it's fair to say, due to the injuries, due to the context, whatever the case may be, we did not get 100% full tilt Giannis on defense last year. I'm curious, like, what do you think their base is going to be defensively? This is Eric Spoelstra, so naturally they're going to do a lot of things. But what do you think they're going to land on base-wise defensively?
Well, here's the thing. That's the fun part for Miami. You now have a combined versatility that makes a whole lot of sense in a way that you haven't had in a little bit. Defense is traditionally the base of the Miami Heat. The better their defense is, the better they are. That's just been the bit over this run. And I think what you have to talk about, when you think about their base, think about this. Giannis, Bam, tough to deal with, versatile defenders. Think about what an offense has to try and do against a lineup that has those two, right? We saw what Bam did defensively next to Khalil Ware. We've seen what Giannis has done defensively in different spurts. You know, hasn't been an all-defense player in a little bit, but doesn't mean he's not a great defender when locked in. That's something Miami will ask. If you're an offense, one of those two, one of Bam Adebayo or Giannis, should be on the weak side for a majority of times, right? And it's not in a forced way. So I'm intrigued to see how offenses treat them. I'm intrigued to see, to your point, how Spo wants to use Giannis when he's involved. In Milwaukee, they kind of did this, like, Giannis is going to be on the weak side and help. Hard to deal with. Giannis is going to be in a drop sometimes. Somewhat easier to deal with because there's space. But okay, does Giannis become more of a switch person? And now, okay, if Giannis is switching, Bam's behind him. If you're doing the thing where you're avoiding putting Bam in action, well, Bam's on the weak side. If you don't want to put Giannis in action because he's defending well, well, he's on the weak side. Who are you attacking? What does that open up? Does that now give Miami some wiggle room, in theory, defensively, where they are both able to nail, we can defend multiple positions, and we can kind of have this switchability and this help that puts, like, puts pressure on you. They're gonna, I think they're gonna cause havoc. I think that's where the interesting part about the buy-in will come. I think Giannis will want to be coached in a certain way, and Spo will deliver that. And I think we get a better version of Giannis defensively because that's the expectation in Miami. And so you talk about the base. I'm not as concerned about the base. I'm more concerned about how much optionality they have, in the sense that if they can hit all of these different things, right, it gets really tricky because where are you going to put, who are you going to put in action? Especially if Wiggins is still there. Like we and Davion Mitchell, like we just have people who can make things uncomfortable. And the presence of Giannis and Bam should empower more pressure on the ball, more willingness to help, more activity. And this is where it gets fun if you're a Miami Heat fan, because in theory, when the Miami Heat defend with a strong base, it opens a lot of things up. And that's before we get to zone. Think about zone with Giannis and Bam in different areas of the court and how that's going to work. And so I think, I don't, you know, we're a long ways out, but I think defensively, if Giannis is nailing that to a high degree, you get yourself into a tough position against the Miami Heat come playoff time. Mm-hmm. Like, we got to see what the rest of the roster is, but they're going to feel comfortable, in theory, with four people on the court being able to guard multiple players. And we've seen that when you have that kind of mindset and that kind of personnel, you can get a run going in the playoffs. Because, hey, yeah, you want to attack matchups. Which one? Where's that? That's got to be the goal for Miami. And I think where Giannis and Bam, for Bam, we know what Bam could do defensively. For Giannis, it's just, okay, does what Miami likes to do elevate him back to where he was defensively?
Yeah. I love that. Like, I think there has been this kind of push and pull with, I think, Heat fans with Miami's defense. Because, like, you have Eric Spoelstra, you're just kind of going to have a top 10 defense. That's just hysterically how that's gone. But, like, balancing Bam being a really good switch defender with, hey, I don't know if the rest of the roster can, like, hold up to the degree that Bam can. And so you get to these areas where teams are putting Bam in action to get him out of the way and then attacking elsewhere. And then you're watching games. It's like, well, why does the defense look like this when Bam is this good? It's not his fault, but it's just like, okay, teams are moving him out of the way because he's so good. Who else can do the thing? As you mentioned, having Giannis in tow, especially if this is the engaged and healthier version of Giannis, it makes it more difficult to do that. It is super difficult to do that to both of them at the same time. And even if you do, Davion Mitchell should be here. Have fun. If Andrew Wiggins is back, he has the $30 million player option. We'll see if he opts in or if he opts out, and then Miami is able to agree to a longer-term deal at lower money to help the free agency period, et cetera. We'll get there. If you do have those four in, I think the answer to your earlier question of, like, who do you go after, it's whoever the two-guard is. And that just kind of has to be the answer by default. Like, I think it's whoever the two-guard is or Davion Mitchell because he's going to be the smallest guy on the floor. But it's not like Davion is a bad defender. And if you have Giannis and Bam on the floor together, you're not going to have the easiest time trying to deal with those two. I think to answer my own initial question, I would imagine, because Miami was third in switch rate last year, like maybe they go from third to like sixth or seventh. We see a little bit more drop, or maybe we see a little bit more of the at the level stuff mixed in because you would have, in theory, Giannis on the weak side or Bam on the weak side. Spo hasn't historically wanted to put two on the ball, but I do wonder how much of that is because he hasn't always had the personnel to do that. Like, he'll sprinkle it in certain matchups, but it is something that he loves to do. If you do have Bam and Giannis on the floor together, you should be able to tap that button a little bit more. So I'm intrigued by that. One thing you mentioned with the zone, Steve, it had me cackling that I was looking this up. Second Spectrum data goes back to 2013-14. That is Giannis's rookie year. The Miami Heat logged more zone possessions last season than Giannis has been on the floor for defensively in his entire career. And I just didn't know what to do with that when I looked that up. And so to your point, like, I do wonder how often Spo presses the zone button with Giannis on the floor. And there's just the general, what is that going to look like for him? But, like, that's just to give you a key of, like, what the volume difference is between the previous context there. But, yeah, I am excited to see what that portion is going to look like. As Miami rounds this roster out, Steve, not going to ask you to give names unless you want to, but, like, what types of players would you like to see them target to fill this roster out?
I mean, I think off the top of my head, what do you think? This is your bag.
My bag. Like I alluded to earlier, like I want some move. I want shooters that can screen for him, because you go back to the Milwaukee days, Giannis inverted actions with Pat Connaughton, more recently Giannis with AJ Green. You want guys that can spread the floor, but are also willing to lay the lumber so Giannis can get downhill to complicate defenses there. So, like, I think in terms of the shooters, you want guys that can ghost out, but are also willing to hit people. From there, I think Davion is going to be there because of the defense, and the drives are going to be important. It would be nice if they are able to land a guard with some pull-up equity to further unlock Bam or Giannis as screeners, which I'll quickly say, we talked about Giannis needing to be more consistently engaged defensively. I think that is fair. The screening is also just going to have to ramp up for him in a way that it just has not in the past few seasons. He does not need to turn into a Brook Lopez, but it does have to be better than what it is to unlock some of the inverted stuff or just the more traditional pick and rolls. But either way, some kind of pull-up artist to kind of unlock him in that way. So that's probably where I start.
Boy, be asking me a question because he, with the answer he has in his brain, I love it. I think for me, it's just about maintaining a level of versatility. And depending on who's available, but you're going to want to have size. You're going to have shooting. You want to have a big that can play with, like, with a double big. You're going to want to have a big that can just play by themselves. Like Bobby Portis, I think, if he stays in Miami, is an underrated portion of the deal, because he can, in theory, do a couple different things for you that fit as far as being able to get you some scoring, being able to do what you need defensively, being able to space the floor. Now, we'll see how that goes. But I don't know if there's a specific archetype I want for Miami, but I think when you go into training camp, you're going to want to have an ability to do multiple things. And I think for me, it's with Miami, with how they play, there's a trust factor there in that whatever they have, they're going to get the most out of them. That I don't know if I would give to everyone else, because that's just kind of what Spo has done. If you look at the players that got traded to Milwaukee, you felt a different way about them at some point before they got traded to Milwaukee. That's just kind of who this team is. So it's a win for Heat culture. To the Bucks portion, do you have any Bucks thoughts, by the way? You're just going to ice out the Midwest, buddy?
I'm not. I was waiting to see if you had more you wanted to add, because I want to transition to the Milwaukee portion. Because there's the obvious cloud of, will this deal expand? And if it does, are any of these pieces going to other places? Like Khalil Ware's been linked to a couple of teams. There was like the early Detroit noise for Tyler Hero, et cetera, et cetera. And so like there's that obvious, we will see what happens on that front. If the deal stays as is, and all these pieces are in Milwaukee to start the season, I am kind of curious to see what Tyler Hero plus Khalil Ware look like without the same weight of expectation. Because I think, as we've seen with the Tyler Hero arc, when he's been healthy, like we know what the shooting is and we know what the pull-up shooting is. He has quietly gotten better as a driver, not to the point to where he is like no doubt about it all-star, though he did make an all-star team. But like we have seen some growth as a playmaker from him. We have seen some growth from him just inside the arc in general. It's something that we talked about over the past couple of years. It's like Tyler Hero playing well enough to get defenses to give him different coverages. And then it's up to him to like make that next step to beat that portion. So him entering this Milwaukee context without, we need you to be number one, or we need you to be, you need to hold your weight with Jimmy Butler plus Bam. We need you to hold your weight with Bam. Now it is just, we need you to be good. I'm curious to see like what that looks like, how defenses treat him. Just from a mentality standpoint, I know Tyler's going to be game for it. He is not going to shy away from this challenge at all. And so, like, I'm curious to see, like, again, how defenses treat him and, like, how he's able to, like, process that in real time and execute. With Khalil Ware, we have seen the highs of, I will swat 8 shots in the game. I could be a devastating role threat. I can knock down these threes above the break. We have also seen the other games where he is getting moved out the way on the glass. He's having off-ball lapses. The shot selection gets kind of wonky. How is Taylor Jenkins going to absorb him? What kind of leash do we see on that front? Because I think the upside is incredibly high for him. But just like what consistent beats would he hit? And now that he is not in the win every day context of Miami, does that just inherently give him more wiggle room to kind of work through some of these things? Knowing I can make 2 or 3 mistakes in a row without my night ending, not just sitting down, but my night is now over if I make these mistakes. Different context for him. How does he deal with that? So, like, that's kind of where I start. We'll talk about Jaime and Kasperson a little bit, but I think that's where I start. How do you feel about the Milwaukee package?
Well, I mean, I think you're starting a new era, the end of an era, especially when you have the like one of the best players in franchise history departing is never going to be easy. It's never really going to feel good. I think what they did was you filled the pantry you fill the pantry. You have pieces that can help you as you start a new era with a new coach. And I think you have a level of versatility as far as like, okay, we just have more bodies that I believe can play better basketball. I think that to me was the toughest part about the end of last year's run for Milwaukee. It just didn't feel like they had enough people to do any of the things they wanted to do. And so, okay, let's just get out of that. And now let's see what we have. So I think, one, you're either going to have people that grow within, that are young and talented, and can help get you to the next level. We've seen Taylor Jenkins embrace young talent. If they get better, teams will be interested in them. You have a little bit more optionality, I think, which is the most important part. So I think for Milwaukee, it's hard to feel great about it, but these are all very good players to a degree as far as what they can do, how they can grow. And I don't think they've hit all their ceilings right away. So you build it out right now.
Yeah. Like the backdrop of like the Giannis injury stuff, plus I want to play, they not letting me play. We never really got a firm answer on like how much was true, how much wasn't. Just felt kind of messy towards the end. So that part stinks just from a fan perspective. But these are some interesting young pieces. Like Jaime Jaquez coming off of a sixth man of the year caliber season. Can he spread the wings even more? Does the shot become more consistent? Does he add even more counters to like the mid-post bag? Like I'm excited to see what that part looks like. Cassius Jakaciones shot the leather off the ball last year from Miami. Like the calling card for him was like, I can run a ball screen and make pretty much any read you need me to. And so like, I am curious to see how much rope Taylor Jenkins gives him. Because I think him getting a little bit more playing time, like, I'm curious to see like what the him plus Ware pick and roll combination will look like. There's some intrigue for me with Milwaukee as they shift to this new era. Obviously, this is like phase one for them. So we will again see if the deal expands, et cetera. We have an entire offseason to go, but fascinating deal nonetheless. Let's stay with the Southeast Division, Steve, because we had yet another trade.
Oh, you're really sticking with this, huh?
Oh, we are absolutely. We are doubling. We're doubling down. We're tripling down.
Zach Lowe hurt your feelings. Okay, it's fine. What else happened?
Not at all. We tapped the vindication button. But the Charlotte Hornets trading away LaMelo Ball and Josh Green to the Minnesota Timberwolves. The Hornets getting back Naz Reid, a 2033 first-round pick, three first-round pick swaps in 2028, 2029, and 2030. Though some of those swaps are a bit convoluted, to be kind, that the interest of time, we will just leave it there. But those swaps do technically exist in 3 second round picks. And so I'm going to toss this to you for initial thoughts. I just want to quickly say the speed run from, hey, the draft is happening, the second round is happening, at the end of the broadcast, it's like, hey, the Hornets are talking about LaMelo Ball. Keep an eye on that. It's like, wait a minute. How do you end a night with that? And then the next day, LaMelo Ball is in a Timberwolves jersey Photoshop. Very much a tailspin for me on that front. But I will toss it to you, Steve. What are your initial thoughts on the Hornets trading away LaMelo Ball after that season?
The Southeast Division captain passes me the ball. You love to see it. I think for me, and I didn't think LaMelo was going to get traded. Wasn't a thought that I had in my mind. I saw that and I was like, oh, this is leverage for something else. And no, it was not. It was a LaMelo Ball trade. Where it gets interesting is this is a swing for Minnesota, a swing for the fences, one I didn't see coming. And you kind of try and break down how, why, what, where. Did they look at the Western Conference? Did they look at last year? Did they feel like that roster they had bumped their head? Did they feel like there was anything else they could do? Because I think as much as it's about acquiring a player with the high potential of LaMelo Ball, they got rid of Naz Reid and Julius Randle, who were key cogs to what Minnesota had built to make these Western Conference Finals runs, right? Mm-hmm. What could they change, Nikias? And it's interesting when you think about it, right? They had Nikhil Alexander Walker. Nikhil Alexander Walker, they could no longer afford. Nikhil Alexander Walker has this year in Atlanta. Hey, we'd really like a little bit more guard play, I think. And so I don't think there's like, this is not a traditional swing for, this is the proven superstar talent, old veteran paired next to Anthony Edwards that's going to take us to the next level. It's not Kawhi, it's not Kevin Durant, it's LaMelo Ball. So how you feel about LaMelo Ball is going to dictate how you feel about this trade from Minnesota. But what they couldn't, it would be hard for them to stand pat, and how many high-level dynamic players like LaMelo Ball are going to be available. And so I feel like this is a perfect world. If you're Minnesota, okay, we need to upgrade our guard room. Whether it's San Antonio, Oklahoma City, teams can't feel as comfortable switching against us. We got to be able to make teams pay if they're in drop. We've got to be able to play outside the play. If Anthony Edwards is going to get trapped and doubled and get all this attention, we have to have more comfort around what is around him, and we have to be able to balance these lineups up. So how much of this came down to, do we like the flashes from Ayo Dosunmu? Do we like the potential and flashes that Jaden McDaniels showed? And instead of taking this and saying, okay, Naz Reid, Julius Randle, your versatility, your drives, you're going to help balance things out. We're going to shift that to these two, and we're going to add LaMelo Ball, who I believe helps the Minnesota Timberwolves. The question is, where does he help them? Is it the scoring? Is it the playmaking? Is it the, like, is it having more balanced lineups? Is it transition? I think you add someone like LaMelo who has that kind of ball handling, who has that ability to shoot the ball, is important. And so he can create his own threes off pull up. He could space the floor. If you're going to run an action with Anthony Edwards and you go to the second side and it's LaMelo Ball, well, that's a lot to deal with in theory for a defense. I think what gets interesting is, and, you know, Dante DiVincenzo unfortunately got hurt. So we lean on getting more leaps from our talent, Io and Jaden McDaniels, and now we add LaMelo to that. How do you feel about LaMelo being able to elevate the Minnesota Timberwolves? Do you feel that he can? Where are you at with that portion of the program?
I think on a basic level, yes, I feel like he can elevate the Minnesota Timberwolves, if for no other reason than he should be able to elevate Anthony Edwards. I think something that you hit on was just the general amount of attention that Anthony Edwards was seeing. Like, some of that was, I have gotten so good, not only can I drive, the pull-up is here, man, to the mid-range game, teams have to put two on the ball on me more. We are sprinkling in more of these double teams against, like, my post-ups and things like that. And so it's a testament to him. But it's also, like, how many of these guards beside Anthony Edwards are we really afraid of? Like, I think that's where the Dante DiVincenzo piece, when you make that trade, that was a part of that. Like, okay, let's get a volume three-point shooter next to this guy. So if teams are going to show this kind of attention, we have a guy that is willing to take 8, 10, 12, 13 threes in the game. As we know, LaMelo Ball will just do that because it's Tuesday. Independent of what kind of attention Anthony Edwards will see, LaMelo Ball will get them up, and he can just stress your defense in a to a ridiculous degree. And so having someone like LaMelo that can take some of that creation burden off Anthony Edwards, you know, we've talked about, again, because he's gotten so good, he's seeing this attention, he now has to balance his own scoring with the playmaking. It honestly, Steve, it kind of reminds me, I guess, while we're here with Minnesota, it kind of reminds me of Olivia Miles joining this team and Courtney Williams just kind of like, oh, I could just be the two. I could just kind of do my thing. Like, I can still play make when necessary, but I could just kind of do my thing now. I wonder if we're going to see a similar element for Anthony Edwards where it's like, oh, LaMelo can jumpstart these transition opportunities. I can just get out and run now. In the half court, I could potentially be more of a second side option now. I can just get these buckets without having the same burden of creating for myself and creating for others, at least when we're on the floor together. So that part fascinates me.
Well, let's hang there for a second, because I think it's interesting. The years they had last year, does that set them up for the most success? The thing you have to realize is these are two very talented young guards, and you don't always get talented young guards together in a room. Right? Like, so if you like Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum together, I don't know how you don't like Anthony Edwards and LaMelo Ball together. Like, they're buckets to be gotten, they will be had. But in Charlotte, LaMelo, hey, you got to play off ball a little bit more. You got to be involved with more movement. You're not going to have every pick and roll. Okay, now I could do that next to Anthony Edwards, and I still have freedom to be myself. I can get the best of both worlds. To your point about Anthony Edwards, hey, I don't necessarily have to do all of this. I have someone who can do X, Y, and Z. I can get off ball more. Because I think that was always the dynamic. It was like, okay, Anthony Edwards, pick and roll, trap. Anthony Edwards, post up, trap. Well, let's get Anthony Edwards off ball. Physicality, bogging down, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, is that going to open him up more off ball? LaMelo has experience playing off ball based on last year. Is that a dynamic we haven't thought about as much to where, okay, they're more prepared to play together than they may have in a previous life?
No, I like that. I think just quickly hanging there, Steve, just the general idea of being able to get Anthony Edwards off the ball a little bit, I think is going to be important, because he has quietly been one of the best catch and shoot threats in the league since his rookie season. Like, well over 40% for I think five straight seasons at this point, including the playoffs, 50% on catch and shoot threes overall last year, but only 144 attempts. If you can juice that number, it doesn't need to be 50% efficiency, though you'll take that if you're Minnesota. But just being able to generate easier shot quality for Anthony Edwards, I think, is going to be helpful. If for no other reason than, if I don't have to self-create as much through the first three quarters, when we get to the fourth quarter, I just have more in the tank to take all these shots that you don't want me taking, or taking the shots that you do want to take, want me to take, but I'm good enough to make them anyway. And so that's what we have seen, like, this past season, early in the year, it was Anthony Edwards and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is kind of your top two clutch player of the year threats before Shai just really took off to close things out, and obviously has this in him. If LaMelo Ball's presence through the first 3.5 quarters gets you there and makes it easy for Ant, you're taking that if you are Minnesota. And, like, even to the Charlotte context with LaMelo, like, I think one of the question marks you had, at least for me broadly, was, okay, what does the late game stuff look like? Because when he's on a heater, he can just break your defense and there's nothing you can do about it. But because he was still growing as a threat inside the arc, but didn't quite get there consistently as, like, a driver, someone that can put consistent pressure on the rim, things like that, what is the shot quality going to look like for him late? And I think broader strokes for the Charlotte Hornets, I think part of the calculus for making this move is, when we do get to the playoffs, because I think we are ultimately going to get there within, if not next year, then in the short term, like, is LaMelo ready to deal with the kind of physicality, the kind of switchability, et cetera, to, like, take us over the hump as our best guy? And, like, does he have, is there a pathway for him being a good enough inside the arc scorer or inside the arc threat to generate the looks that we need? If you're asking me, I think he could have eventually got there, because I was seeing the incremental steps over the past 2-3 years for him. But I do understand where that may be a concern, because one of the things we talked about, and you know, I've sung the praises of what the Charlotte Hornets were in 2026 in particular, but you did just kind of look like, hey, this is very perimeter-based. This is very transition-based. The half-court offense was good, but, like, a lot of it was based on, like, the guard screens and getting cons slipping out and stuff like that. It wasn't a ton of rim pressure for them. And so, like, LaMelo being in the context now, we're like, oh, well, Ant can just get to the rim when he wants to. I can play off of him. I have some tilting to play off of. Like, I think that's an easier context for him. And I would imagine that's at least part of the calculus for the Hornets making this move. But it is worth noting, one, LaMelo Ball is very good at basketball, which is why the Wolves wanted him to begin with. Two, for all of the LaMelo plays unserious and all of those things, there are late game moments where it's like, hey, we don't love these turnovers. But he was just one of the most impactful players in basketball last year. Like, I don't think that is said enough. I don't think that has been acknowledged enough. The Hornets were a completely different team with him off the floor last year. Offensive rating was about 12 points worse when he went to the bench. The field goal percentage for the team was about 5 percentage points worse. Turnover rate went up by nearly 3 percentage points when LaMelo went to the bench. Half-court offense was nearly 10 points worse with LaMelo on the bench. They obviously got out in transition more with LaMelo on the floor. Like, he, with his flaws, and I think, again, there are understandable questions tied to those flaws, he still influenced so much positive basketball for the Hornets last year. And this is with him dealing with, like, the early minutes restriction, coming off the bench for a little bit. Let's not lose sight of how good and how impactful this guy can be while he is trying to figure things out. And so that's where I'm extra excited to see him in his Minnesota context, where, like, he's playing with someone better than him.
That's the one. That's the key. Does that trigger the growth? Like, you got to remember, like, I understand the physicality point people are making. He's 6'7 still. Like, it's not like he's small. So here's my thing, right? If you were arguing that one team, and go ask a Knicks fan if they're happy LaMelo Ball is no longer in the Eastern Conference. Just ask them real quick. Just a quick passing question. What I would say is, if you're feeling like one team feels like, okay, we can't compete against these teams if we have LaMelo Ball as XYZ, why would the team that is going to have to go through OKC, San Antonio, insert Western Conference team, add him to the program? And so do you now unlock more paint touches because, hey, we need you to be physical in this pick and roll? Yeah, the three is going to be there. Can you turn the corner? Can you open things up? Can you make these passes? You're going to be asked to do different things in this scenario potentially. And so we wait to see if that's a growth point. Could not be. The other portion is, and one thing, LaMelo is going to have to be able to hold up defensively. But that's the story every scoring guard in the history of the NBA. You're going to have to be able to find a way to get to do your job at best and see what happens. I think the questions about the Minnesota defense are fair. My retort or my other thought, or however you want to phrase it, were the questions about Minnesota's defense ever going to go away? So many people take these screenshots of Naz Reid, Julius Randle, Rudy Gobert on off splits. You didn't feel great about the Reid-Randle combination. You didn't feel great about one of those two at the five. So you had questions about Minnesota's defense no matter what. You're replacing it with a bet on the offense, right? So, yeah, LaMelo is going to have to be able to – you got to be a little switchable. You're going to have to nail, show, and recover if that's what you're asked to do. Whatever you're asked to do, you're going to have to nail that because Dante, Mike Conley has been a history of activity. But if you take a little bit off the defense and you boost the offense up in theory, is that a trade-off that this Minnesota team had to make?
Had to make? I don't think the answer is they literally had to. I think there were different pathways to them to balance things out. Because I think heading into the offseason, I just kind of imagined Julius Randle is going to be gone in some capacity. And so I was kind of anticipating Naz Reid going to be starting four. And then they kind of round out the rest of like the 3-5 room, however they see fit. I did not, to your super earlier point, anticipate that both Julius Randle and Naz Reid were going to be gone. And so not only are they making a shift in terms of like we are tilting this more to the offense, we think enhancing the offense is going to make life easier for us overall. There is like a shift in like maybe not literal size, but at least physicality profile for this Minnesota group that I'm curious to see how that plays out. And obviously we have an entire free agency period to go to see how they continue to round out their roster, similar to the Miami Heat portion. But like, what does this mean for, just off the top of my head, like what does this mean for starting lineup? Like, are we going to get Jaden McDaniels starting power forward? I'm intrigued, but like, what does that mean for the glass? Like there, you know, downstream effects to that. Are they going to add a stopgap so they can still have this level of collective size with LaMelo, Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, insert four here, Rudy Gobert, to at least replicate some of the size and physicality that they can get into teams? Because you look at their Western Conference Finals runs, a lot of it is we have size, physicality, and to your point, activity across the board. And when we are all locked in to whatever our game plan is, we have skill and we can just flat out bully you. They are just losing the bully portion with Julius Randle and Naz Reid at the door right now. Independent of, like, I think LaMelo is a better player than both of them. But to the actual profile of the team, it is going to be different. And so I'm curious to see, like, how they go about shifting it full sail. Like, I think that is a fair thing to keep tabs on.
Well, again, we're early on. Let's see how the rosters break out. So we'll see what they do. They do need to, like, I don't want them to do the Philadelphia from 2 years ago where it's like, yep, we're just going to go into small ball. It's like, well, you need some optionality. So we'll see what kind of things they add to this roster. But intriguing swing. From the Charlotte perspective, interesting times. You remember when, like, it was, what, like 7-8 months ago when it was like, hey, LaMelo doesn't want to be here anymore? And it just kind of went away. And LaMelo bought in, and the Charlotte Hornets had success. Boy, did you talk about the Charlotte Hornets having success on this podcast.
Sure did.
They managed LaMelo Ball. They got him through the season. The minutes ramped up. He was able to play. He was a big part of their consistency. Did someone in that building wonder if that was enough? Did someone in that building wonder if they could do it again? Did someone wonder what it would look like if they could not do it again? If something were to happen, did they look at the Trae Young scenario in Atlanta? Did they look at Ja Morant, who the words of the, how are you adding words to he's available to be traded? I've never heard that in my life, but that's a different story.
Yeah, that's a different one. Flagrantly available.
Was it a purpose? Was it a perfect storm where they saw people wanted LaMelo Ball based on last year in a way they hadn't? I think overachieving is one of the toughest things to manage in the NBA. And we have seen teams have success in this league, believe they have something and found the core, and they try and build on top of that. And boy, that wasn't it. They never reached those same heights. I don't think Charlotte was in that boat. I think they were still on the rise to a degree. But maybe this is a perfect storm to exit and move forward. I don't know if I could sell that to a Hornets fan with what LaMelo Ball meant to the city, with what he represented, with the success Charlotte had. I don't know if I could. It's hard when that ends. But I think as good as LaMelo was last year, the Hornets did work to, hey, you don't have to cook as much, LaMelo. You just make the mac and cheese. That's all you got to do. You don't have to make chicken. We got everything else. So we're fine. You know what? Actually, appetizer. We just need you to bring an appetizer. That's it. That's all you got to do. Just bring an appetizer. We'll be fine. So we got more movement. We got more flow. We're empowering Colin Knipple. We're empowering Brandon Miller. We're not making them the guys, but we're going to have a little bit more equal opportunity. It doesn't have to be you and pick and roll to open things up. They still needed his drives. They still needed a shot creation. They still needed him to make plays. But we're trying to build something philosophy-wise. So, well, if we don't think that we can do that again, and we are afraid of what it looks like if we do not, and there is interest in taking this. Yeah, Nasri. What's up, man? Come on down.
Yeah.
Come through. You can shoot, play 5, 4. You can do stuff. Well, to a new era. New eras are not pretty. I don't know. That's where I was at. What do you think about the Charlotte portion?
No, that's fair. And, like, I'm glad you hit on, like, beyond the basketball portion with the Charlotte piece, because that's what I was going to hit on as someone that, born and raised in South Carolina, like 30-ish minutes away from Charlotte, have lived in Charlotte now for the last 5 years. It cannot be understated how much LaMelo meant to the area. And as the Hornets made this run in the calendar year 2026, and really going back to like mid-December, if you would really want to expand it out, the way that the city came to life for the Hornets specifically was something that I hadn't seen in a while. It was palpable. And like seeing some of the fan reaction and like watching some of the news and seeing getting some of the fan reactions from some of the anchors and things like that, they are not pleased with LaMelo being that. We got a firm, like, reverse the trade call from one of the from the Charlotte fans in the area, right? And so for the Hornets to press this button, like, I don't disagree with you, Steve. Like, I think, in fact, like, I would just firmly agree with you. Like, clearly someone or some people in the building felt like either this isn't as sustainable as we think, or there are some just questions about LaMelo specifically that I don't know if we really want to commit to. Whatever combination of it is, you don't make this move without that being there, because otherwise, this is a 24-year-old all-star with obvious upside that just helps spearhead, you know, one of the top 5 teams in the league in the calendar year 2026. That, as the graphic for the people watching on YouTube earlier, a 125 offensive rating with him on the floor, like, just very obvious, really good, really impactful. So I think you do have that piece of the port, that piece of the pie there. If you are going to make a trade like this, where you are moving your face of the franchise and one of the most popular players in the NBA, period, you got to be right about it. You have to nail this to this degree. I am intrigued by the Naz Reid piece. We have seen in previous seasons when he has been asked to start 16-8, 17-8. I think within what Charlotte does philosophy-wise, with the inverted actions, with the general off-ball movement and things, like, I think it would. I was talking to a pal of mine yesterday. It's like, do not be surprised if Naz Reid averages 20 a game next year. With his skill level plus what Charlotte does offensively, that is not off the table. I think he's going to help. And circling back to our overall physicality portion, having someone that is as skilled as Naz Reid and as physical as Naz Reid, like, I think you do add a little bit more juice to the half court in a certain way. But hey, you're going from LaMelo to committing to Coby White as your full-time starter. Like, there is a playmaking gap between the two. Who's going to be your draw two guy? Is that going to be Naz picking at mismatches? Is that going to be Brandon Miller continuing the growth that we saw last year inside the arc? Does he become a guy that consistently draws two? Is that going to be Con Knipple in any context? We will see. Because if you do not nail that, you risk, one, like, losing the trade, but two, a fan base that was super into the Hornets, lost them, got them back. This is kind of eh. We got Kemba and Al Jefferson. This is kind of eh. Now we got LaMelo. We just had a really good 2026. Things look great with LaMelo and Con and Brandon Miller, and then we trade him. You don't want to risk losing the fan base if this deal does not hit the way it does. Now, I have been impressed with what the Charlotte front office has done over the past couple of years. They have earned a level of benefit of doubt to me, and they do now have more pick equity. They have a whole bunch of money to work with. Very real chance that they end up building a more balanced roster and this ends up working out. But they do need to do it if you are trading LaMelo, considering how much he means to the area.
Every time someone gets traded, we say the team has to nail the trade. How many times has the face of the franchise been traded and the trade was nailed?
It's a good question, Steve. It's a good question. Well, I mean, I guess...
Clyde Drexler got traded for Otis Thorpe. Pau Gasol got traded to the Lakers for things that made people yell on television. These things are never pretty. So the Charlotte Hornets, and yeah, I'm not disagreeing with what you said. You're right. They need to play hard and they need to win. That's what they have to do. And so if you are betting that you can do that, you better do it, to your point. Mm-hmm. If you don't do it, it's going to feel like it was 2-3 years ago. So that's on them. That's their choice. I think it becomes interesting, like, how do you deal with that? And so you said, who's the two on the ball guy? Who's the starting point guard? All these debates, like, it's not like LaMelo was getting trapped all the time. So you're going to have to find a way to build your offense up and hope Brandon Miller and Colin Knipple take a step to where, yeah, we can have movement, but they are able to be more involved.
Okay, one more trade to get to, Steve, before we fully transition to the W side. We did have a three-teamer, which I guess still has a chance of expanding. We will see. The Brooklyn Nets acquiring Julius Randle from the Minnesota Timberwolves, as we alluded to, Naz Reid and Julius being in different places. The 28th overall pick that ends up being Joshua Jefferson. So both of those pieces going to the Nets. Nick Claxton going to the Chicago Bulls. The Wolves receiving the 33rd overall pick that ends up being Isaiah Evans. Mahamadou Gay, the other Mogay, going to the Wolves as well. Non-guaranteed contract expected to be waived. We'll see what happens on that front. And then tied to that, you clear that money. The Wolves giving Ayo Dosunmu a 5-year, $112 million deal. So that's where some of that money went. Where did you land on this trade, Steve? What was your initial reaction to this one breaking?
I had a hard time processing the fact that Julius Randle was a Brooklyn Net. Like, and number one, hopefully him and his family are happy. That's got to be a whirlwind of finding joy in this opportunity in Minnesota and having success. It goes a little bit left, and now you're back in New York, only on the other team. And the team that you were on won a championship. So that's a lot. But the attempts from teams are going to be interesting in this new era, the draft relegation. You have to do something. You have to be something. So what are you adding to elevate your floor? And so I don't mind Brooklyn, because they've always been a home for a bucket getter to a degree. And so Randall's versatility, his drives, his quick decisions, that should help elevate the Nets in the half court, as they've been known to try and grind to find an open shot. Well, you got someone who can get in the paint, got someone who can post up, you got someone who can do more things. So I get that portion of it. Nick Claxton to the Bulls, didn't expect that. Like, I think it's just interesting that it's like, hey, you got cap space, we got cap space. Do you want to have a quick chat?
Let's talk. Let's talk about it.
And so I think if what's intriguing, and I know this is your portion of the program, but can Nick Claxton recapture the form? Because I think there's an element sometimes of a different context serving someone better. And with where Nick Claxton is at in his career, has he bumped his head at the top of the ceiling? He came on the scene with defense, versatility roles. Has that been lost, or has it just been diminished because of the context? The Bulls' context isn't massively different, but it's a more wide open landscape to a degree. Will the athleticism around him help? Like, what does that look like? So wax poetic about the Chicago Bulls getting Nick Claxton.
I love how all that is in parentheses, like it didn't happen. But I am fascinated by the Nick Claxton piece of this. Actually, before getting to Nick Claxton, the Brooklyn Nets needed some downhill juice. Julius Randle should provide plenty of downhill juice. The Nets were, I think, 10th in drives per 100 possessions last year. They were 27th in points per possession off of those drives. Julius Randle should help. And I think just having a higher offensive floor, in theory, should allow them to set the defense up a little bit. Now, I am praying for Jordy as he has to navigate Julius plus MPJ defense potentially off the ball. We'll see how engaged they are going to be. But you are just adding a higher base in the half court, and like having two guys that can draw that kind of attention should make life easier for all the guards that you just drafted, plus the one you just got. So like, I am fascinated by that piece. To the Nick Claxton portion, one, you start with the boring but obviously important health piece of this. Anything concerning a back is scary, and it is especially scary for bigs. You want to make sure that is as okay as it can be. If there is a reasonable level of health for Nick Claxton, hey, man, we got some athleticism in the room. We got a role threat in the room. We have someone that in Brooklyn just ramped up the playmaking, decision-making to a ridiculous degree, averaged a career-high 3.7 assists last year, a whole lot of handoffs, whole lot of two- and three-player actions involving MPJ. And so if you are looking to maintain your flow, which, quick shout-out to Thiago Splitter, new head coach of the Chicago Bulls, I think Nick Claxton could be a piece of that, in addition to like the collective size and collective creation that the Bulls have on the roster right now. So like, I am just intrigued by what the Bulls are building overall, because it's just a lot of tall guys that can do stuff. with the ball. They can either play make, drive, create their own shots, or some combination of the three. So that is fascinating to me. If Nick Claxton is healthy, the offensive usage can be varied, and defensively, we have seen at different points of his career, I can be super switchable. Going back to that December for Brooklyn this past year, where they finally turned into like that top 10 defense, I can get up to the level and truly bother people. And I think the Bulls have been looking for a consistently higher defensive base for quite some time now. Nick Claxton should be able to help with that. But this all starts with how healthy is he going to be? Because if he is not, then you're not going to feel as good about the bet. Like, you still essentially got him for free, so you're not going to feel too bad about it. But the ceiling obviously lowers if he's not healthy. But you know I'm a big fan of Nick Claxton, so I'm hoping that he is healthy. And if he is, I think Bulls fans are going to enjoy him on both ends of the floor. Okay, actually, Steve, if you will indulge me, I apologize to you and our producers. Can I ask you a couple of rumor-related questions before we close the NBA section?
Sure, man.
I have a couple of Jalen questions for you. So, one, we kind of alluded to it early on, but like our own Kevin O'Connor talked about the Wolves having some conversations with Boston concerning Jalen Brown. Ultimately, they land LaMelo Ball. Jalen Brown was reportedly available in the Giannis conversations. Giannis goes to Miami. Do we think Jalen Brown is going to be a Boston Celtic at the beginning of next season? Or do you think the relationship may have soured to the point, or that teams are just super interested to the point that he may actually be elsewhere?
I mean, there's always a possibility, never say never, but I think he goes back to Boston. I know the thing is, the relationship is, you can't repair it. They did this before. Hey, we got a shot at KD. We put your name in there. I'm so sorry. Hey, we had a shot at Giannis. We put your name out there. We ain't trade you, though. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what it's going to take? 4 first-round picks. See? That's you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We ain't really want to trade you. Come on back. What do you think?
Okay. Like, I would lean to, I'd say like 70-30 that he's back in Boston. But, like, I think because they've done it before is part of why I'm like, at what point does Jalen Brown, coming off of the career season and all the things, and he is, and I say this like not negatively, but like he is a prideful person. Like, he believes in himself, hence this year being what it was for him. At what point is he like, all right, man, if y'all gonna keep putting me up, at this point, just let me go somewhere where I could just be the guy. Like, I have my ring, I have my finals MVP. Y'all keep putting me in these conversations with people that are better than me. Let me get out of here, type beat. So that's where I'm just like, does he reach that point? Ultimately, again, I'm 70-30 that he's back in Boston, but I am keeping an eye on it because this has felt like a lot of smoke since the Giannis thing actually went down. So keeping an eye on that. And to the other Jalen thing, I think from Sam Amick of The Athletic, not pleased with how early negotiations going with the Detroit Pistons. May look to pursue some sign and trade opportunities because of how far apart he and the Pistons seem to be. This is where I would plant my flag firmly again on the restricted free agency as a scam thing, but at the interest of time, I'm not going to go on that rant again today. Are you at all concerned with the Detroit Pistons Jalen Duren negotiations?
No. I mean, okay. I think if you're Detroit, right, we want to get you back. We want you at this price. Jalen Duren didn't like that. We had this playoff run. All right. So if you're Detroit, it's like you're either going to come back here or we're going to trade you. You can do a sign and trade. We'll get some pieces. Like, I'm not overly concerned off the top of my head with this being thrown in my head. What about you? It's leverage season, the guys.
It is indeed leverage season. And so that's where I'm just like, okay, who are the teams that still have cap room that you could actually leverage this to? And if you're talking about sign and trades, like, you don't actually have to have the cap room. I'm just fascinated by this because I think when you have the year that Jalen Duren did, where he was good, and then he leveled up and he's like, oh, snap, this is all NBA level stuff. And then K goes down. It's like, holy crap, this is really all NBA level stuff. And then you have that playoff run. You already have a natural inclination of like, okay, do we really want to fully max him or can we shave like $5 million per year off of this, but still keep him? And then you factor in just the inherent restrictions of restricted free agency where it's like, okay, we're kind of bidding against ourselves because if anyone else tosses you something, we can't just match this type beat. So like that also shrinks it more, which is why I'm not a fan of restricted free agency as a concept. I am fascinated by this. Detroit has been looking to be aggressive all offseason, it would appear. And so I would guess as of June 26th, like they work out something and Duren is just back. But I certainly can't rule out sign and trade opportunities because like there are still like decent bigs on the table. Yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, Steve. So thank you for indulging me. Actually, before we officially go to break, shout out to my guy, Jake Fisher, from about 30 minutes ago as we were recording on a Friday morning. From him, There's also a potential backstop emerging for Boston's Jaylen Brown trade discussions. Detroit is very much weighing the prospect of signing and trading restricted free agent Jaylen Duren for Brown, sources say, among other conceptual outcomes. I love that I had like quick Jaylen questions to close out this section, and now there is the possibility of the Jaylens being traded for each other. I do find that funny. I have no idea if that is a thing that is going to happen. We will see if anything pops up over the weekend. But some fascinating things happening right now between Detroit Pistons and the Boston Celtics as they look to improve their teams this offseason. Okay, we are going to take a break from here. We're going to shift to the W when we return. We got all-star returns. I am currently in Vegas. I was here for the last two games. Going to talk about the Aces. And Marina Mabry got all the buckets. We're going to have some fun. Please stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift back to the WNBA. And, buddy, we are coming. Oh, is that a Tempo shirt?
Yeah.
Fantastic work.
Yeah.
Fantastic work. Yeah. You know what? I may just concede the floor early. We are starting. I am currently in Las Vegas. I was here for the Liberty game on Tuesday, the Wings game on Thursday. So I have some Aces thoughts. And so we were planning to kind of kick it off with that, just to kind of take shop, little contender check in, et cetera. And then Marina Mabry happened. And she's been happening, to be clear. The last four games have been incredible for her. She ties the WNBA single game record for points in a game with 53. She also tied the W record for made threes in a game with 9. 9 of 18 for 3 was incredibly efficient inside the arc. And just absolutely lit up the Los Angeles Sparks. It ends up being a 125-97 victory for the Tempo in this game. Still no Brittany Sice. Another piece is missing as well. Kiki Rice not back yet for the Tempo. Unbelievable game to absorb. Again, I was at Aces Wings, so I didn't get to watch this one live. Watched it back this morning. I'm just like, good gracious, what do you do when she has the pull-up going to this degree and she's letting you hear about it after every three? But Steve, you have long been, at least among the two of us, a much bigger Marina Mabry fan than I. This feels like an opportunity to clear the floor and let you cook.
We're here. Marina Mabry made history. Got buckets. Do you respect bucket getting? You should. Marina Mabry got all of them. Now, here's the thing. The best part is 9 of 18 from 3. 17 of 28 from the field. 53 points. What could you have done? Because some of these shots, we know Marina will get them up. We know Marina will get up in a different way. Some of the shots she made, it's like, oh, she's on something. She's on one. Most points in the first half for someone this season, because I watched it live, right? I was not at Aces Wings. So I was like, okay, Marina's cooking, right? First quarter, 19 points. Continues to make through threes throughout the second. Doesn't stop. And this was not quite like, it wasn't like, it was almost like when we watched Bam do that, I was like, oh, Marina has to go for 50. Right? I was sitting there like, Marina has to go for it. She has to go for 50. And I was concerned because it's like the shot, the type of shots that Marina takes and makes can gather itself to, well, yeah, she's going to go for it. It'll look great. But it also is, those are some tough shots that you're taking to try and get this. So I was a little concerned as that game wore on, like, ooh, okay, her legs getting a little tired. This is a lot to try and process. And the game was, quote unquote, out of hand. But like, you have one chance at history. So, so shocking that I was waiting for a post up or a backdoor cut or something, but Ethical Hoops wins again. But I mean, the blend of step backs and logo threes and deep threes, it just didn't matter what they were doing. Marina was getting to her spot and letting it fly. And I think it's where sometimes you just kind of think of a player and you put them in a box and you leave them there. And I don't think you should do that for a player like Marina Mabry, including other players. Think about this, right? Nikas, you tell me who has the most points in a single game and unrivaled, and the most points in a single game in the W?
On the unrivaled front is Marina Mabry. On the W front, it is Marina Mabry plus Asia Wilson plus Liz Cambage.
No, not the question I asked. I said, who's the person who has both?
Well, I mean, technically, she's tied with the others, so, you know.
She's not tied with anyone. Can't, can't give,
can't fully get. No, she's not. She has the unrivaled one. That's what I said.
I'm saying there's only one person that has both, right?
Kinda. What?
No, that's not how it works. That's not how that works.
Oh, I'm messing with you.
You know what?
She's getting buckets across multiple leagues.
No, I want to hear what you had to say about Marina Mabry, because you sat here for years on this podcast, opined about trade for picks, opined about secondary trade, said Marina couldn't get it done, and now all-time performance. So what do you have to say, bucko, pal, chief?
What I have, chief? I ain't heard chief in a minute. That's when you put hand on shoulder, like, hey, don't call me. But anyway, I was very impressed with the shot making from Marina Mabry. And have been impressed with the shot making for Marina Mabry for a couple weeks now. Like, obviously, longer than a couple weeks. She's been getting bucks for a long time. But as mentioned at the top, she had been on a run already. You can never predict that someone is just going to go for 53 on a random night. But, like, she just had, like, 37 a couple games ago. Like, she was in the midst of a little bit of a heater anyway. And so for her, as you mentioned, to hit the amount of shots that she made, but the degree of difficulty on these shots, it felt like the side steps and the pull-ups kept getting deeper and deeper. And she got more audacious after the shots. Like, that's probably my favorite part of the Marina Mabry experience. She makes a shot. She looks directly at defender and says something. If she makes a second shot over the same defender, it goes from one sentence to, like, three. If she makes another shot, then it may go from three sentences to, like, four words. Like, yeah, you know what's up. And then if she makes another one, then it might go to a five cent. You just never know. But she's going to have something to say over this. And so, like, just watching this getting more and more audacious, I'm just like, if you're the Sparks, like, what do you even do? Like, we have talked about the Sparks defense. We've seen flashes of what it can look like. For the large portion of the season, it has been bad. They had a 143.7 defensive rating in this basketball game. And they are now, Steve, to bring back an old favorite of yours. The Los Angeles Sparks currently have the worst defensive rating in WNBA history right now. That's not where you want to be. It's not where you want to be.
You're gonna ruin this time to join the chorus of people who turn on a Sparks game and take their hands and they type into their computer or their phone and they say, oh, this is the worst defensive team I've ever seen. Oh, I can't believe you would trade for veterans. Oh, this is horrible. Do something else. Do something else. Yeah, they don't have Cam Brink. The defense is bad. Do something else. They right there. What you gonna say if they win? You sitting here saying the same thing every game. Do something else.
Do something else is sound advice. And this is why we start with the praise for Marina Mabry, because that is just an insane shot-making experience. And it took me back. I'm glad you brought up Unrivaled. It took me back to that Unrivaled game where she set the record, scored, 47, I believe, and had 27 in the first quarter of that game, where the shots, again, became more and more audacious as the quarter went on. And so for Marina to have that kind of heater, it was impressive to watch. It was fun to watch. She obviously deserves the massive salute. And that does kind of, we'll get into all-star stuff a little bit later, but go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, I had three audacious questions, so I want to see where you go.
Okay.
About this Marina before we move. So what were you going to say?
I was just going to say all the way off. Oh, no. I'm not. We're not moving all the way there because we're closing with all-star stuff. I was just going to say she was already in the conversation, if not being a starter, but at the very least making the team. After a 53-point performance and after doing so that efficiently, she's just at like 21-4-4 on insane splits. Like, the season was already good. It looks even better now. And so it's going to be even easier to argue that she should just be in there. And so, again, we'll have the full-fledged all-star stuff a little bit later in the episode. But I just wanted to sprinkle that in since we were talking about Marina. Like, just unbelievable game.
Very good. We can move. I've had my fun. I won't hammer it to home too much. I'll ask my three questions, though. One of them you'll kind of answer. So all-star worthy, you'd agree? Yes?
It should be in consideration, yeah.
In consideration, right? Are you prepared for, as the Toronto Tempo or the current 8 seed, are you prepared for the Marina Mabry MVP conversation?
Not quite, no.
Interesting. Was she worth all the picks after all?
I still think that was a very bad trade for the Chicago Sky. I can't move off of that one too far. Like, that just wasn't...
See?
I'm sorry to say.
53 points still holding. And, hey, we'll get growth there. We'll get growth one day. That's fine. What else you got?
I can salute Marina Mayrie without saluting Chicago Sky for that trade, in which Marina did not.
Sure, man.
But, okay. Well, as I am currently in Vegas, Steve, we ended the Monday pod with fascinated to see what the Aces look like this week. As they see the Liberty for the first time, they're going to see them again on Tuesday for the Commissioner's Cup Championship game. And then on Thursday, they're going to see the Dallas Wings, a team that has given them some very specific issues. And the last time those two teams matched up, that game was over pretty darn early. And so I was like, okay, let's see what this looks like. They faced the New York Liberty on Tuesday, Steve, and the Liberty went 87-76. And one of the first things Becky Hammon said after the game was, this was a good learning experience game for us, just to kind of see where we are. And so I'm not super mad at the loss. But as she talked a little bit about pregame of the Wings game, I did feel like we were a little bit passive in this one. And so, like, watching the Aces try to figure out what to do with the Liberty size was an interesting bit for me. I was like, you know how I feel about the Liberty and their collective size. Like, they can just pose problems that nobody else in the league can when they're fully healthy. And so watching the Aces getting to their switching, and the Liberty's like, well, bet. Jonquel Jones is just putting me underneath the basket. Let's see what you want to do with it. Here's help. Here's a kick for a three. Oh, no, what are we going to do? And the Aces is kind of toggling through coverages to see, like, how can we put this offense in the box? While also not feeling super comfortable on the other end. Like, the drives weren't as frequent or as deep. They didn't have the same three-point shooting success. Breonna Stewart heated up late as they were trying to make a little bit of a run, and the Liberty won that game. I was like, okay, interesting. And then we get to this Wings game. And, yeah, I had you in my head as I was watching this game, because for 85-90% of that Wings game, it was like, this is what the Aces defense can look like. When they are not only switching, but switching with a level of aggression, when the rotations are crisp, when the communication is strong, they can defend at a high level. The big thing, as we've been saying all year long, they just have to hit these notes consistently. And so as you look at the two-game breakdown against the Liberty, a 111.5 defensive rating that would, if extrapolated across the entire season, be one of the worst marks in the league. Against the Dallas Wings, a defensive rating of 100, which would be, I think, the second best mark in the league. 31 three-point attempts for the Liberty. Again, a lot of attention drawn inside the arc. Led to some closeouts, led to some kickouts, got some threes. 33 three-point attempts for Liberty. Only 21 for the Dallas Wings, and we know that they are a team that wants to get them up. Again, the switching was pristine. Three-point shot quality for the Wings was actually a bit higher than it was in the Liberty game, but because you couldn't get the shots up, you didn't get dinged to the same degree. Pick-and-roll defense, over 1.1 points per possession against the Liberty, 0.98 against the Wings, so much better performance there. And off-ball screens, 1.18 points per possession for the Liberty, 0.91 against the Dallas Wings. So it's just interesting for me to kind of soak in just how differently the defense functioned, which I think just kind of leans to the general theme that I've had with the Aces all year long. They have a level that they can hit. They just need to hit it consistently. And this is something that Becky Hammon also said post-game of the Wings game. Like, we are making strides. We just got to get there consistently. I have to be able to pull this out of them consistently. We want to be playing our best basketball at the same time. So those are just my overhead thoughts of that two-game sequence as I'm still here. Steve, how did you absorb these last two games for the Las Vegas Aces?
Well, I mean, just to bounce off what you said, I think this is what the regular season is for. You have to go through the highs and lows to understand what you have to get done. And so I think for me with the Aces, defensively, have you earned enough trust in what you do? Are you decisive, and is there versatility? I think in the Wings game, they showed, okay, we have a comfort. We can defend. We can fly around. There's a level they know hit. The interesting part, going back to the Liberty game, because it's funny, you like to hammer home the point that, oh, the Liberty have an element of size that has consistently bothered the Aces, which you forget the reason why the Liberty have a level of size that bothers the Aces, because the Aces used to bother all of the Liberty small guards. So they said, no, we're going to have a whole bunch of wings and you have to deal with it. It's fine. So that's the back and forth there. It'll be interesting to see what that rematch looks like in the Commissioner's Cup next week. We'll talk about that next week. I think one thing that was interesting, they only got 8 free throw attempts against the Liberty. They had, 33 against the Dallas Wings? That wasn't – that's a little bit different. So what you have is Jackie Young, Asia Wilson, them being able to dictate terms offensively really shifts things. Like, Asia Wilson is Asia Wilson. So, I mean, if Asia has a tough time shooting the ball, how many teams are going to draw that out? Liberty, probably you put on that list. But mm-hmm. if it's not going and Jackie's not having an easy time, that becomes, okay, we are confident and not as consistent offensively. But if we don't have those two going offensively and our defense is getting dinged, that puts us in a different scenario, puts us in a different fight. Yeah. Against Dallas, I think it was probably a better defensive performance. But you had the consistency of what Asia and Jackie Young were putting on the table. Jackie Young had 20 points, took 6 shots. Asia wanted a get back against the Dallas Wings. So, yeah, we're driving this home. Chelsea Gray is Chelsea Gray. So we're going to make these plays. The interesting part is, okay, how does the bench develop? Drew Lloyd playing with confidence, I feel like. Can I point to a box mm-hmm. score and say, hey, this? Nope. I can tell you what my eyes are saying. A little bit more comfort there. Cheyenne Parker-Tice.
Yes.
We're going to get you on board with both these bigs, Nikias. We're going to get you on board. I got a memory. But Cheyenne feeling a little bit more comfortable with him, what they're doing mm-hmm. on both ends of the floor. Yeah, I can make sure I do what I need to do defensively, but hey, I can roll, I can drive, I can finish. Don't forget, mm-hmm. I was a very talented player, and now I'm playing mm-hmm. for the Las Vegas Aces. So they're understanding who they are. I think that's the dangerous part about the Aces to a degree. They're in that mm-hmm. top tier for a reason. So I think that's probably my main takeaways. It'll be fascinating. The Liberty, interesting stretch. Again, you go to Las Vegas, you get the win after losing to the Sparks, and then you go to Seattle, and the future hits you in the face real quick. Here's Flauje Johnson dropping points and defending all your guards, and also Dominique Malanga getting 20-10. And, oh, what fam? Like, the Storm are coming. Like, I just want to briefly mention that. It's not happening this year, but they're a fun team to watch, and those three, it's going to be hard to deal with them at some point. That's not – ain't even had Ezzy mm-hmm. yet. So,
yeah.
Continue. Sorry.
No. You're good. I actually wanted to hang on the Aces bench for a little bit because this has been such a weird start to the season for Jewel Lloyd, and largely because she has not made shots to the degree that we are accustomed to. And I recently asked Becky Hammond about how she's absorbed the Jewel Lloyd season so far with her role shifting a little bit. And I got to talk to Jewel this week after a practice, just kind of asked like how she's doing, but ultimately how she's adjusting to the role shifting a bit, because it has been like the shot profile is a little bit different for her. This is the highest 3-point rate that she's had in her year, which simply means the percentage of shots that she's taken. So if she takes 10 shots and 7 or more threes, 3-point rate is 70. Like, that's just how that works for people that aren't familiar. But like, that has been more extreme, but she's also taking fewer shots than we're accustomed to. This is with her having to initiate a little bit more offense, initiate more sets for the Aces in light of Kennedy Carter still being out. We have not gotten to Dana Evans' debut yet. And so it's just been weird for her. So it was cool for me to see, like, even expanding this past week, to see some of the shot-making start to return for her. In addition to, the defense has just kind of gone under the radar. Like, Jewel is really doing her job. And I think in the Wings game specifically, Steve, she was a big part of why they were able to close off a lot of the cuts that we had just seen the Wings get consistently in the previous two matchups. The communication was pristine. She also just did a great job of doing her work early. If I feel like this off-ball screen is coming, I'm just getting into the body and I'm steering you a certain way. And you're not going to get the easy stuff. Like, there was a possession in the second quarter, I want to say, where her and Chelsea Gray have to navigate the screen or navigate a cut off-ball. And it was a switch. And then the Wings, as they do, when they feel a switch, we're going to slip through here. And then Jewel calls that out too. And Jessica Shepherd ends up throwing the ball out of bounds, trying to hit Paige on the cut. I mean, it's just like that, in a literal sense, is not going to go on the box score for Jewel Lloyd. But she made all of that work. And so, like, seeing her continue to stack those kind of plays defensively while finding her form offensively, I think is important. And to the Cheyenne Parker-Tyus portion, this is someone that I want to bring up, so I'm glad you got there first. I think this was the vision for the Las Vegas Aces when they brought her in, when she was going to be fully healthy. You are someone that can give us a legitimate scoring punch off the bench. And to see that it's not just post up, that it's not just jumper, that's not just drive, but it's a legitimate mix of the three is important. Like, this is back-to-back games with double digits off the bench for her. First time she's done that in an Aces uniform. And the level of comfort and the level of confidence that she's playing with has been a joy to watch from a personal standpoint, because she's just back in full blast at this point. But for the Aces, it's important, as they have been, you know, one of the quieter subplots of this Aces season has been in the second half of games, or just one on a broad sense, who is going to be the primary backup on any given night for Asia Wilson. Some nights it is Cheyenne because they want the offense. Some nights it's Bree Turner because they want the defense and the switchability. And so that has been Cheyenne more consistently over these past handful of games. It speaks to how well she's playing and the fact that she is also doing her job for the most part defensively, because if she was not, these would just be Bree Turner minutes, frankly. But she has gotten to a level to where, okay, we trust you to do your job enough. We now can get more of the offensive punch, and she is producing on that front. And so I want to give the salute to Cheyenne for what she's been able to put together over these past couple of games.
Frankly, I see. Understood.
I'm just saying. Can bring one more Aces thing while we're here? Or I guess technically sure. Two. I want to say, well, one, just very quick salute to Chelsea Gray. As we you know, we had her on the pod recently and mentioned in the intro that she was close to eclipsing 2,000 career assists, which puts her in rare air. She did eclipse that mark in Thursday's game against the Dallas Wings. And naturally, she gets that assist off of like a sideline out of bounds play, hits Kirsten Bell underneath with a ridiculous pass, and she gets that one to go. The passes she was tossing in this Wings game, like, it's Chelsea Gray, so no one should be surprised that she's willing to try some wild stuff. But, like, she had a drive in the second quarter, pick and roll with her and Cheyenne Parker-Tyus, where she hits, like, the Chris Paul yo-yo dribble, goes baseline, jumps in the air, has to navigate three bodies while she's in the air, find Cheyenne Parker-Tyus for a layup. It's like, okay, that's kind of wild. We later on get a jump ball that was forced by Nalissa Smith against Jessica Shepherd. Nalissa Smith wins the jump ball. Ball goes to, I think, Asia. Goes to Chelsea. Chelsea immediately chucks a football pass to Jackie Young, like 60 feet. And I was like, what am I watching right now? And this is just in the midst of just the general, quote unquote, complimentary nonsense that Chelsea would throw in the middle of a game, because she just sees stuff that other players don't. So I just want to salute the playmaking and her having that amount of flair in the game in which she reached a personal milestone. So that part was cool. And okay. I just wanted to quickly note, the Jackie Young pull-up is just kind of absurd right now. And I'm still trying to figure out what to do with it. Because on one hand, my process brain is like, Jackie, you are probably still the best driver on the team, especially while Kennedy Carter is still out. So, like, please get deeper into the paint. But also, I think she drew 3 fouls on pull-ups last night against the Wings. And just in general, she has so much comfort and confidence in the pull-up too, and can get to it in a very quick manner. She is being more audacious with the pull-up threes, particularly in transition. She has been on a shot-making heater for like a month at this point. You know, following the slow start to the season, Jackie Young just seems to be firmly here offensively, and that is a very important development for the Las Vegas Aces. So I just wanted to stay there to kind of close.
Very good.
There we go.
Understood. Well done. Love to see it. What else you got?
Okay. Well, from there, let's move to the All-Star conversation, Steve, as we got our second bit of voting returns earlier this week. The fan vote officially ends on Saturday, so if you're listening to this, get your votes in. If you have not already, you got today and you got tomorrow, and then that is it. The fan vote accounts for 50% of the tally for the starters, which is going to be 4 guards, 6 front court pieces. So, per those second returns, Steve, your top 4 guards right now, Caitlin Clark, who went from 5th overall in votes to 2nd, Paige Beckers, who went from 2nd in total votes to 4th, Kelsey Mitchell, who went from 10th in votes to 9th, and Olivia Miles, who went from 9th to 10th. So those are your 4 guards per the fan vote. Obviously, 25% for the media, 25% for the players. So we'll see what it ultimately ends up being. But per the fans, those will be your 4 guards. Well, AZ Fudd, once again, is next up. Will be the 5th guard. She is about 49,000 votes behind Olivia Miles. So that's not unattainable, particularly how deep the fan base is. So we'll see. And in terms of the front court, Steve, Aaliyah Boston, now your top overall vote getter, going from 3rd to 1st. Asia Wilson goes from 1st to 3rd. Breanna Stewart goes from 4th to 5th. Jessica Shepherd remains in 6th. Angel Reese remains in 7th. And Gabby Williams remains in 8th overall. But those are your top 6 frontcourt players. Natasha Howard remains next up on that list. But the gap has widened between her and Gabby Williams. So it looks like those are just going to be your 6 in terms of the fan vote. So any surprises with any of the movement or any of the overall down ballot stuff? Anything catch your eye on that front?
I don't have any surprises. I mean, I think, once the first returns came, moves were made to make some votes. But I think the names were settled after the first returns, to me. Like, once we see Jessica Shepherd and Gabby Williams get the votes, I think that kind of settled things out. What's going to be interesting is what happens with the media vote and the player vote, and who does that affect in the front court? Because I think in theory, it should be Aaliyah Boston. It should be Asia Wilson, Aaliyah Boston, Stewie, Shepherd, Gabby Williams, Angel Reese. That probably should be the six in theory. But the player vote and the media vote can A, not align, and B, get a little wonky. So does Natasha Howard get enough of the fan vote to kind of keep things close? Does Kiki get enough of the fan vote to make things interesting? I'm not sure. I think the six should be settled, but that's something I keep an eye on. I think the guards are pretty locked up at this point, to me.
Okay.
I think Paige is going to be there. Caitlin Clark was going to be there. Olivia Miles keeps doing things. She's going to be there. And so I think, you know, with Kelsey Plum going down, Kelsey Mitchell being there makes sense. I think Ollie Chagre late push could get interesting. So it'd be interesting to see if like Ollie Chagre and Ryan Howard were flip flop guard wise for the fan vote. What would that look like? Mm-hmm. But I think the guards are settled. I think the starters are in for the most part.
Okay. That makes sense. Like, I think for me, I'm probably with you in terms of the fan vote. This is just kind of how it's going to play out based on where we are. Like, we have had some double vote days and things to close these out. So there's always a chance for something to flip after what happens today plus Saturday. But I'm pretty much with you on that front. I would just say, like, on my personal ballot, again, don't have an official media one, but we had the All-Star conversation a week or so ago. I mean, for me, my four guards, when we had that chat, had Kelsey Plum, had Olivia Miles, had Paige Beckers, had Ryan Howard in. With what Caitlin Clark has done since we had that conversation, like, I think Caitlin was going to push someone out anyway. With Kelsey Plum being out for a month, like, that is just the natural, you're likely not going to be available for All-Star things. So, like, my four guards would just be Ryan, Olivia, Paige, and Caitlin. Caitlin, since we had that conversation on June 12th, 23.5 points, 8.3 assists, 61% on twos, 39% from three, 75% from the line. You don't want that. Drives have continued to hit both in terms of volume and what she is creating off of those drives. Pick and roll play getting better. Like, we had the conversation when we had the initial talk. Like, I was like, she's an all-star to me. I don't know if I can get to top four yet because of a few areas. Like, she has gotten better. She's playing better. Plus, you have the Kelsey Plum thing on top of that. And so Caitlin would just be in for me. And as you mentioned, when we had that initial conversation, she was going to be in anyway. And so, like, that's where I have a little shift on my front. The front court does get interesting to me, though. Because I know I was in a headlock thinking through the final two or three spots. As someone that had Alyssa Thomas in the first time we had it, like, she would probably be, like, first out for me right now. And so, like, that would open up a spot. And then I would just quickly want to say, and I guess, like, offer, like, somewhat of an apology. Because I've talked about Gabby Williams throughout the season on the pod, but like not really through the All-Star context. And she has just kind of been top 10 in votes. And so it is worth acknowledging she is just having a very good season. She has been insane defensively once again, averaging 16 points per game, shooting 37% from three on over five attempts. Both of those would be career highs right now. And so like she was not a starting front court piece for me, but like someone that very firmly deserved to be in the conversation and still deserves to be so. So I just want to, like, on a personal standpoint, say as a fan of Gabby Williams, I should have said a little bit more within the All-Star context about Gabby Williams. I want to do that right here. So I am fascinated to see like where the player vote and the media vote lands with her specifically, because she has been good, but she is still going to be in the class with, you know, the names that are already listed. You got Asia, you got Stewie, you got Aaliyah, et cetera. But just Jonquel Jones' season has been very good. We talked about Natasha Howard. Like, there are a lot of good front court pieces. So I'm fascinated to see how that piece lands. But she deserves, even if she's not a starter, she deserves to be there. She has been that good. And I will once again say, the Ryan Howard thing is just going to make me sad, man. She should be in the guard group. I'm sorry to beat the dead horse, but that makes me sad. I think her and Alicia Gray are both going to be All-Stars this year, so it's not going to materially matter. But based on what the fan vote is, she does just seem very, she stays pretty far away from like actual starting with this cast. So we'll see what the actual results end up being. But she's been a top 10 player in the league for me. I want to see her start because she's been that good. I'll once again sprinkle that in.
Okay.
So there we go. So while we're here, Steve, actually a guard question for you. Because we started this with Marina Mabry. Any chance for her to sneak into the starter group between like the media vote and the player votes?
No.
Just a firm no. Okay.
No, okay. The four guards are settled. There's no shot. Marina, salute to Marina. I don't know what. Two of these names will absolutely be there. Olivia Miles is likely going to be there based on that play. That's three names gone. Marina doesn't have enough of a fan vote. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's probably fair. She's having a great season. She's coming off of that game. Just wondered like how much momentum would push it. Again, to your point, the fan vote does have her behind, but does the media see her high enough with the Temple currently being a playoff team right now? Obviously, Brittany Sykes is down, so she gets more of that focus. That's where I'm just like, is there a chance she ranks high? Like, I would...
The media is going to have three names down. I don't say these things accidentally, Nikias.
No, I get it. I'm talking through, like, why I wanted to ask you the question. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm just explaining the... No, you're good. Just explaining the logic behind it. But that's want to see where you were on that front. I will say, before we get out of here, I do want to echo your sentiments that Seattle young front court with Flage, Alfam, and Dominique Malanga is just absurd. Man, that is so much athleticism. And not just athleticism, but like skilled athleticism. I don't know what you do when they hit their final forms. Especially together. Like the Dom piece, that's one thing I wanted to get to as I was thinking about players I wanted to shout out during the All-Star section. Like Dom has only played 11 games, so she wasn't going to factor in super heavily for me onto this. But this is 20-10 in three of her last four games. She's coming off of that. She's not too far removed from the 37-12 game, that overtime thriller against Dallas. The drives, Steve, from Dom Malanga, the drives and the post-ups from Dom Malanga are super intriguing for me. Like she just seems so much stronger and sturdier. And when you already have that athleticism and just the general nimbleness that she has, like it just makes her so difficult to deal with. And then Alfam just runs like a gazelle. I'm intrigued by the defensive versatility and some of the athleticism that she's displayed already. The quick trigger shot, just a smooth jumper on top of that. Like that, man. I'm having a lot of fun. And again, Flage can be ruled around the board. She's going to drive, put her head down. Coming off the 28-point game against New York. Like that is a fun group of young players. And I was thinking about it this morning, like, obviously you have, you know, the Lynx, the Aces in the West. You have the Liberty, the Dream in the East. But what the Mystics are putting together with Sonya and Kiki and Shakira, et cetera, you look out West, the Seattle group is going to be super interesting. And again, that's nothing to say about, like, Dallas is already good right now with Paige plus AZ, et cetera. Indiana's obviously good right now. Or can be good with Caitlin, Aaliyah, et cetera. Like, I am fascinated by what the next 3-4 years of the league is going to look like as those young teams at the bottom of the standings ascend, and you still have this young group of good teams, and you still have the Aces and the Liberty battling things out. The league is in a good place from a talent perspective. I think that's the general note that I wanted to hit before we got out of here.
Very well done. Very well done. And since we're getting out of here, and there's nowhere else for me to put it, OKC traded Isaiah Joe to Detroit for 2 future second round picks.
Huh. Okay. That is fascinating. We will talk about that more on Tuesday's episode in the NBA section of the podcast. So thank you for that. Well done for Detroit. We'll get deeper into that. This is the W section. But thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo main YouTube channel. That's where the W content is going to live. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. That is where the NBA analysis is going. Just like that's where you'll get my Isaiah Joe thoughts next week, apparently. You can follow me on socials at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.